All right, welcome back to the podcast, Desert to Grassland. And I'm here again with Roger Savory. We're talking about the project out in the Salton Sea, Desert to Grassland, Feeding the Future. And there's been a lot of questions about how we would feed cattle out in the middle of the desert, especially in the Salton Sea, where you go about 30 feet before you find a plant. So Roger, welcome. And can you explain a little bit more about how you would feed cattle in a desert where there's no food?
Well, luckily, the Bible actually gave us a hint. And in the Bible, they talked about a group of people who escaped from one area and they ran to another area and they called it the land of milk and honey. And basically, they described paradise. Now, if we think about, well, what does this land of milk and honey have to have been like? We have to ask ourselves a couple of very simple questions. To create a land of milk and honey, what do dairy cows require to make milk? And the first thing they require is large quantities of water. So then we have to ask, well, what does water need to be created? And water needs soil that is covered with mulch, so that the 85% evaporation doesn't occur. Bare soils, the rain that falls, evaporates almost immediately. Covered soils, the rain that falls, percolates and gets stored in the ground, where it can then flow out at the low point in the topography of the land, and that becomes gently flowing streams with crystal clear water. So for the land of milk and honey to have had milk, they had to have had ground cover. Now, the best source of ground cover is grass. However, grass in the diet of a dairy cow is only required for about 5% of their diet. The reason for that is the grass is the fiber that pulls all the food through the gut so that it moves through the gut without getting stuck. Because let's remember, cows do not eat grass. Cows eat the microorganisms in their intestines that they farm. Once again, cows do not eat grass. They eat the microorganisms in their intestines that they farm. So then we have to ask, well, what do the microorganisms in the intestines need? Well, they need a diet of protein and carbohydrate. So that comes to the second part of what does a cow need to give milk? A dairy cow, notice they didn't say the land of beef and honey, they said milk and honey, because a beef cow requires a different diet than a dairy cow. A dairy cow requires a diet very high in protein. Now, the number one plant source of protein for a dairy cow is legumes, peas, you know, alfalfa, etc., etc. Now, coincidentally, legumes also have flowers, and bees need flowers to make honey. Notice grass is wind pollinated and it doesn't have any flowers. So the grass was only needed for the lignin and for the ground cover to fix the water cycle. The legumes are needed for the protein for the cows and for the flowers for the beehives. Now let's move on to the bees again. What else do bees need to make honey? Well, legumes are a source of flowers, but so are all the broadleaf forbs, the tap-rooted forbs. So if you picture your flower garden, that's what all those plants are. So for the land and milk and honey, it has to have had grass for ground cover, legumes for the dairy animals, and broadleaf plants and forbs for the flowers. Now, what's the final thing that the land of milk and honey needed? It had to have had large trees on the savannah because the bees need somewhere to build their hives. What they were describing was an area with an extremely biodiverse forage, grasses, legumes, broadleafs, many different varieties, because flowers only flower for a short period of the time in the year. Bees have to have flowers year-round to keep making honey. So it has to have been a very biodiverse mix of legumes and broadleaves and trees, because remember, different trees flower. So when they described the land of milk and honey, they were describing an absolute biodiverse ecosystem. coming back to how will we feed the animals, we need to grow an extremely biodiverse forage mix on those irrigated lands north and south of the Salton Sea to feed the animals. So that's what we will do. Currently, most of our mixes have over 120 species of plants that we've identified that make meat taste good, that are not poisonous, et cetera, that we utilize for feeding these livestock and feeding all the soil microorganisms and the fungi. So in answer to your question, it was a very long answer, we have to grow the food nearby, but an extremely biodiverse mix. We're not talking about fields of alfalfa. We're talking about fields that might have an alfalfa plant in them, amongst the other 120 things. And then once that forage has grown up, then we will harvest it, chop it, and transport it to the desert to feed it to the livestock. And or if we need to increase the energy levels, we'll harvest it, make silage, which is where you compact it with a tractor, and then basically it turns into alcohol and increases the energy levels if we find we need that. Sometimes in the cold weather that can be needed. That will then be transported to feed the animals and chopped, cut, moved daily and regrown daily.
I just wanted to ask, what's normal? What do they normally eat? How much diversity do they usually get?
Oh, most of the big operations grow corn, feed them corn as the grass, and then might give them some alfalfa as well. Most of the big operations, just three types of plants.
Wow, so like no nutrition.
Very, very mild nutrition, yeah. No diversity of species. And that's why all the meat tastes bland.
I grew up in the Midwest, and I remember the beef just tasted so amazing. And I came out to California, and I was like, I don't understand. It just doesn't taste right. And I'd go back to Illinois and get so excited to have a steak again. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot that this is what it's supposed to taste like.
Yeah, yeah. And those animals were coming straight off the pasture. It's a different product.
So another question I'm sure everybody has, gets kind of expensive paying somebody else around the Salton Sea to grow all this forage. But then at what point in the project will we not need to be paying somebody else to grow all this forage? Because the advantage of doing it, you know, down at south of the Salton Sea is they have the irrigation. And with this project, we're not going to be irrigating land.
So you're mixing two parts of the project. So as far as healing the deserts of the world, until 2/3 of the planet have been turned back into grassland ecosystems, we're going to be paying someone to grow the grass. And that is fantastic. I love that because that created employment. Remember, we've got another 1 billion humans being born. We need more meaningful work for humans to be part of and be proud of. A project where you grew the food to feed the animals that turned the world from a world that had no hope and no future, and climate change was the greatest disaster facing the planet, and you were part of the team that solved the problem and made it so that your great-grandchildren had a fantastic life with clear flowing rivers, abundant wildlife, and cooler temperatures and more stable climate.
So I think my point was, once you have the cattle go through the land, about what, a year later, 2 years later, after it's rained and after you've gone through a few seasons, you actually have forage again. Is that without irrigation? Is that correct?
Yes. So that was my point. You're mixing two things. So the growing the food to feed the animals that fix the land and turn it from desert back into grassland is one part of the project. Once the land has been healed and we've jump-started the life cycle and we've got the life cycle functioning again, then step two becomes, okay, what caused it to turn into a desert? How do we prevent it going back to a desert? We've spent all this time, money, and energy getting things working again. Let's make sure we don't repeat the same mistake. Now, the same mistake would be pulling animals off the land. So then we have to have herds of breeding animals that breed up exponentially over a 20-year period, breeding animals to then maintain the forage, cycle the carbon each dry season so that it grows each wet season, then recycle it each dry season. So then we have to have a maintenance herd. Now that's your normal thing with cowboys and shepherds and sheep and goats and cattle, and they are maintaining those herds, and the offspring from those herds can then go into the herd for fixing deserts. So then we would have the desert healing herds of young animals that are going to be eaten, and we would have the keep deserts, grasslands herds, which would be your breeding cows and sheep and goats, and they would be to maintain this perpetually into the future.
So can you briefly talk about how we plan on making this profitable? Just kind of in brief, because I think that most people don't realize, you know, what we're proposing here.
So in broad brush strokes, the large meat companies sell an animal for about $8,600. There's been a bit of inflation per animal. And then the farmers generally sell their animals for anywhere between $800 to $1,200, depending on what's happening with the market. So let's say you buy an animal for a round figure of $1,000. You look after it for 3 to 6 months in the biological carpeting program. Once it's slaughtered and processed and sold, it's now worth $8,000. So you've got basically $7,000 worth of money to pay for the people who cut up the animal, package it, sell it, and for the feed it required for the 3 to 6 months to grow in size. So, and then because we're going to be grass finished feeding, there's two things that happen. One, we get paid for the increase in weight in the animal. The second part is we get paid for the fact that grass finished, biodiverse, nutrient dense meat, the market is willing to pay more money for than the competition feedlot meat, which the CAFOs are polluting the environment, polluting the atmosphere. They've got the methane gas issues. They've got all those negatives associated with them. So I think within a year or two of us getting this model up and running, I actually believe all the feedlots would go out of business, because people will very quickly realize that there's a new model that does good, not harm, and they'd rather support the new model that does good, not harm.
You had mentioned that you can buy the animals for $800 to $1,000 a piece. How does that work? I mean, can't the farmers just sell it straight for $8,000? Or are you saying that you're buying them when they're younger and they don't weigh as much? And then you're, because of the way you feed the animals, they increase weight. And so then they're worth more.
Well, all animals increase weight. The thing is, most farmers, their business model is to have a mother cow herd, bring the animals to weaning, and then sell off their animals at weaning so that they can carry more of the mother animals on their land. So that's the majority model. Most farmers need a market at the end of the summer to sell their weaners and get the most money for their weaners to make room for next year's crop of weaners that'll be being born. That's just how our industry works. So I've got to work with the current industry.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Let me summarize what we're doing with this project. We're starting with 5,000 acres and getting up to 150,000 acres a year. At 5,000 acres, how many animals is that?
About 15,000.
Okay, so we've got about 15,000 cattle, and we pay farmers south of the Salton Sea to grow very diverse amount of forage. We cut it. We deliver it within a few hours to the cattle, and the cattle are creeping across the land like caterpillars and depositing that bio carpet, which is about an inch thick of dung and urine and a certain consistency that you kind of know at this point. It's protecting the ground. It's protecting the ground from UV light, but also from evaporation. And it also creates that wonderful medium for growing things, mushrooms, and then grasses and broadleafs and legumes. And then we buy the animals at about $800 to $1,000 each. Those are the weaners. They eat really well. And after 2, 3, 4, 5 months, they're a lot heavier and they can be sold for over $8,000 each. And then that money generates the profit that we need to continue to either pay investors or to get more land and get more animals and to continue to do this. Did I kind of get this all right?
I think you got it in a nutshell, yes. It's so easy. Why isn't everybody doing it?
Well, and I guess that's the thing. I met so many skeptics. I'm kind of shocked at how people are so skeptical. I showed a few friends a picture of the before and after, and I've actually shown them a picture, you know, of a fence line where there's grass growing on one side and it's like bare on the other side of the fence. And I guess people just don't realize that that's when you work with livestock properly, that that's what it does.
Yeah, and livestock are all we have left. It's just when we change how we make our decisions. When you understand the requirements of the grass, when you understand the requirements of the fungi, when you understand the requirements of all these different life forms and try and give them what they need for their life cycles.
I think there's one more thing that we forgot to really mention about how this will be profitable. You like to follow this with chickens or sometimes also use or sheep or goats, depending on where you are in the world. And if we did that, that's just another source of income.
Yeah, the chickens are required for making sure that they eat all the fly eggs and the maggots, that you don't have a fly problem until such time as the dung beetles find the herd. And then hopefully the dung beetles will be doing their bit, generally only in the rainy season. So the chickens give you an added fringe benefit of the eggs that they like laying. They're a kind of a vital part of the micro ecosystem just for keeping things clean. And then the next stage becomes, okay, we've got 150,000 acres that was a desert. Maybe it was worth $500, $1,000, $2,000, depending on where in the world it is, or $10, depending on where in the world it is, because it was desert, no one could see a use for it. As soon as it's covered with grass and legumes and, you know, shrubs and everything with flowing water again, I don't think humans will see it as valueless land anymore. So now you've got these ranchettes or ranches that can be developed on it, which I think now have significant value. So that's the two things. One is the financial system that humans have created by giving land a value. And then the other one is the financial system that humans have created by feeding humans. Both in our modern world would turn into a profit.
Okay, speaking of dung beetles, I think that's something that we've never really touched upon. It was fascinating to me because I know we were having a conversation a few months ago and you were talking about how important dung beetles are. And then we were talking about mudslides and how that would change everything. Can you just touch a little bit on the importance of dung beetles in this whole process?
Dung beetles, you have to have your grasslands with your legumes and your forbs. Then you have to have your livestock. And then you have to have your dung beetles. They're that important. So the dung beetles dig channels deep underground. We've got some dung beetles in Africa that bury their eggs 9 or 10 feet deep. The big rhino scarabs, their dung balls are about 4 inches in diameter. Well, if you've got a 4-inch ball being dug 10 foot deep, that's a 4-inch by 10 foot deep hole for any hurricane, cyclone, storm, water to run down that channel and into the soil and be trapped. For a functioning water cycle, for healthy animals, dung beetles are absolutely vital. Fortunately, ivermectin, which was used as a dewormer, was the DDT of the 90s, and it killed billions of dung beetles around the world and is still killing dung beetles. Should be outlawed, is a great dewormer, but an awful thing within our ecosystem. As I say, ivermectin is the DDT of the 90s. And I said that in protest of what it was doing to dung beetles and how when we saw the dung beetles no longer in our paddocks, we saw that ranches just went terribly wrong when they no longer had dung beetles performing the vital function that they do function in brittle environment grassland ecosystems.
Well, in wrapping up today, there's just one more thing I wanted to say. I'm really excited about running the cattle through the land and seeing what might pop up that we thought was extinct, because I know that I've done this all over the world, and it seems like quite often you end up with some kind of, whether it be a legume or grass or whatever, popping up that either there was no record of before because it was so old, or of it being there, Or, it was thought to be extinct like decades and decades ago. So I'm really excited to see what happens once we get these cattle going in the Salton Sea area, in Imperial Valley.
Well, you say that. I'm really excited to see two-thirds of the planet realize that we can fix the land and we don't have to live in a desert with blowing sand and dust and heat, and we can actually return to the land of milk and honey and paradise just by changing how we make our decisions.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, that's the most exciting is like, wow, we can actually feed people, we can actually fix the desert, we can fix the water cycle, we can stop all the air pol or a lot of the air pollution, we can make a lot of those chemicals inert through the fungi. I mean, there's just when you list it off, the true profit, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. So I'm excited that we're getting a team together and we're trying to figure out how to get more humans on board and excited about this so we can actually do it.
Well, thanks for joining me today. If people want to see more information, they can go to fixdesert.com.